First, the Summit County Council meeting in a work session tomorrow at the Sheldon Richens Auditorium starting at 2:40 in the studio with a preview. County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
A legislative update, but it seemed to be a glitch with this. When we clicked on it, it seemed to be from February of 2019. Maybe just a date error?
It could be. I'll have to check on that one when I get back to the office.
Okay, so what have we got going on?
This legislative session, I think you've heard this before, is a really strange one where we don't have a whole lot being discussed that we're seeing. We've got a few things that we're watching, a lot of land use items and some other items related to county governance. And then we're all waiting to see whether there's going to be anything more on in regards to tax reform. But it seems like the legislature is still kind of heating up and trying to get their stride, not really knowing where revenue is going to hit. I think that's probably the biggest thing that we're seeing.
Yeah. So what are the land use items that you're watching?
Well, I mean, we see things every year. I think the main thing that we're seeing is little touches every year of challenging local authority on different things. One of the big things being affordable housing. We really don't know where they're going to come out on that. They want the legislature as a group wants more affordable housing, but there's a lot of influencers in that, both the home and building industry, and then of course local governments who have sometimes different desires in that regard.
Okay, let's see, at 4:25, then a discussion regarding an installation by the Museum of Natural History of a permanent commemorative marker in Summit County. So what's this about?
So this is an interesting program that the Museum of Natural History is trying to, as part of their program to promote the science fields. They're putting markers around the state that people can go up to, they can interact with their smartphones to get information, and you can kind of go through a process of almost collecting the different markers around the state. In this case, out in the Silver Creek Village, actually, in that area, there was in the past, I believe in the early 1960s, part of a saber-toothed tiger was found there, as well as we have more recently, as excavations have been done out in that area, found petrified trees. So that's the area that they're going to be putting a marker at.
Okay. Let's see. The county council will be selecting a project option to repave Hoytsville Road. How many miles are we talking about?
Well, it's several miles, and it kind of goes just south of Colville all the way into the Wanship area, and it's due for doing some reconstruction work, and we put three options in front of the folks that are along that road, just repaving what's there now. Which, you can stretch the dollars a lot farther when you do that, up to adding shoulders, little wider lanes, and then a separated path. Obviously that would take more dollars to do and probably more time. Not sure where it's going to turn out. I think the surveying and the public meetings we had on this had people preferring kind of a mid option, which would allow for a side path in the future, but would provide some wider shoulders for people to walk on and bike on. Derek Radke will be going through that with the council this week.
Okay, and we're talking about anywhere between $2 and $6.5 million, 2 years to 7 years.
Yeah, and obviously, that's the way you look at it now based on how we have dollars allocated. But we depending on the option that's picked, the council could accelerate that project by rebudgeting as well.
Yeah, and so does this money just come from the general fund, or does this come from some of that tax, transit tax?
Well, it doesn't come from either. It comes from our Class B road funds that we get through gas taxes, and that gets applied to that. But it's not saying that any of our gas taxes, our sales taxes, couldn't be used for that.
All right. The county did take a kind of a postcard poll of residents who they do seem to prefer that wider option with the shoulders on it. So What's the cost and timing on that?
Well, it's kind of mid-range between the two extremes. So I'm guessing kind of the four-year range, as well as somewhere in that $3 to $4 million ballpark. And you know, again, that's provided that we do it with the allocations that we have now, based on our some of our long-range budgeting. We could accelerate that if the council chose to.
Okay, and then you've also got some appointments to the Board of Health.
Yes, so I did interviews this last week for Board of Health, actually over the last 2 weeks. We had, since we had two or three that were reapplying to be on the board, and they will be reappointed. There was one opening, and I'm putting Chris Cherniak's name forward to the council for ratification.
Okay, and this board, I mean, does actually what? Sets policy?
Oh, yes. So this is one of the boards in our way of government that actually does set policy. They are the ones that adopt the health code. So everything to do with water quality and how we do restaurant inspections and all that kind of stuff is all governed by the health code.
All right. And then Temple Har Shalom, the council will be honoring them, but the honorary day is actually July 12th. Why are we doing this so early?
This is the date that the folks at the temple came in and asked us to do. So we're putting in front of the council at this time.
Okay. And what's the honor? I mean, what are we celebrating?
I'm not exactly sure the specifics of it, but it is to honor the temple itself and their work within the community.
All right. And then just also wanted to ask you kind of off agenda, what's going on with the burning debris in Browns Canyon, something that Councilmember Doug Clyde has brought up.
Yeah, he's brought that up several times, and this has been an issue. It's not an issue just for this year. It's been an issue in the past. We've got some property owners out in the Browns Canyon area that have conditional use permits to do certain types of work. And you'd probably be familiar with the area where Nuzzles & Co. is located in Browns Canyon. Well, there's some other properties out there that have, you know, they have different kind of rock quarrying operations, or, you know, there's been a composting operation out there in the past. There's some owners that are allowing companies to kind of do lay down yard type work out there. And store construction materials. Well, there's at least one property owner that has been documented to be burning, and we're not exactly sure what they're burning, but they're burning, and it does violate their CUP. So we've been working on that, but it also you know, the regulations around burning are really covered by the state and the Department of Environmental Quality. And they have not been as active as at regulating those things as we believe they should. So we're working with the state on that.
Okay. So we don't know what they're. I mean, is it garbage?
It probably is a mixture of things. It could be wood products. It could be yard waste, that type of stuff. We're not exactly sure. So in a lot of ways, there's some other nefarious activities that go out there. You know, there's sometimes illegal dumping that goes on, that type of stuff. Also working with the Department of Environmental Quality on that. It's just an area that there's stuff going on there that really doesn't follow our code.
So is the concern just perhaps an out of control fire, or is it the air quality issues?
Yeah, it's mostly the air quality issues, and you know, there are ways that they could come into compliance. You know, from our perspective, we want them to be in compliance with our code, and right now they're not. And you know, these property owners, at the same time, if they want to do other things with their property in the future, they first have to come into compliance with what they're currently allowed to do before we'll process that.
Okay. Let's see. Last week, Public Works Director Derek Gradke spoke about some difficulties that Republic Services is having in serving areas in Silver Creek. What are the issues?
So nothing really new. You know, we have a few neighborhoods, Summit Park, Upper Pine Brook, and in the Silver Creek area, all that have unique issues in regards to trash collection and recycling collection in the winter. It closely follows snow events and the way that roads are plowed and how quickly they can be plowed in regards to those snow events and when those pickup days are. The Silver Creek area, as we know, roads aren't all paved, and they're maintained a different way. You know, you can't salt unpaved roads, or they don't react well to salt. So it's just different conditions, and the trucks that Republic use, you know, they chain up, they're four wheel drive, but even in those cases, sometimes when those snow events hit on the wrong day, they have a difficult time getting to everywhere.
So what do we do about it?
Well, we work very closely with this, especially the Silver Creek, the Service Area 3, who maintains those roads, in order to make sure that Republic, if those snow events happen, they can't get it to it on the regular day, that we try and come back the next day or sometime very close in order to pick up those areas. And, you know, it's really down to about 25 properties that we have trouble with. Those 25 properties know who they are, and the service area knows who they are, and Republic knows who we are, and it's just a matter of communicating better so that we can make sure that people don't go too long without being serviced.
Yeah, and can the county put a dumpster somewhere, though? At least people
well,
get rid of their garbage?
Know, that solution has been talked about. The service area and some of the residents haven't desired to have that kind of service. I'm sure home service is preferable to having dumpsters, or maybe the visual of having dumpsters sometimes is not the right way to do it. I think that's one area that we're really going to have to reexamine as we do get into recontracting or putting out an RFP or doing it ourselves in the future. We make those decisions over the next few years, because it's not unique to just Silver Creek. We have other areas in the county that are challenging as well.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I've got nothing else, Leslie.
Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's 8:28. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Planning Commission meeting tomorrow in the studio with a preview. Planning Director Bruce Erickson, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see. The Planning Commission having a work session to discuss a proposed 15-lot subdivision at 5000 Royal Street. We know it as Huntsman Estates. Maybe talk about some of the tricky items within this application that the commission needs to pay attention to.
There's a couple of things that are a little convoluted on this one. This one is part of the original Deer Valley approval. It's inside the Deer Valley Master Plan. There is an assigned density to that location. The project moves forward under several names, Westview, Huntsman, and now it's the Huntsman again. There was originally approximately 30 units approved on that site in the original Deer Valley approvals. That one was reduced to approximately 15 when the Huntsmans bought the parcel and put the large house and garage up there. There are 14 remaining unit equivalents inside the Deer Valley agreement that are allowed on that site. So we're trying to work our way through 30 years of process to kind of figure out. And so the planners decided it was a good idea to have an early work session and just let the public know what's going on rather than getting too far through that. The Huntsmans also own the property below Deer Valley Resort all the way down to Marsec Avenue, above the Marsec 100, just about where the truck runaway ramp is. And there may be an opportunity, and we're not going to guarantee anything, but there might be an opportunity to move some potential density around to protect that property that's below the Huntsman parcel down to the highway in exchange for one or two additional lots inside the Deer Valley MPD. Deer Valley has said, okay, we're willing to talk. And let's talk about how to do this. So we're not fooling around with Deer Valley's agreement. They're aware of it. We've had a couple meetings with them. We're not guaranteeing anything, but there may be one or two units that could go on this ground that everybody thinks is really nice trees.
Well, and I think there's a trail in there as well.
There's a couple trails in there. Couple of them are casual trails that were built by a couple famous members of our community who will remain nameless, including myself. So we're going to work through it, but we just wanted to make sure the Planning Commission got an early heads up on this one.
All right. So these would all be accessed then off of Royal Street?
Off of Royal Street.
And presumably would be large houses, if in fact that's what...
Large is relative. They would roughly match what's in American Flag and Evergreen subdivisions. So in the staff report, you'll see a comparison of lot sizes and house sizes. The applicant is, you know, not all the way down the road on their application yet, so we've asked for some visual simulations. We've asked for an arborist, silviculturist study on the forest health in that location. And then we're going to ask for silviculture on every individual lot before we go in there. So for your purposes, Leslie, back in the day, we used to save every tree. And you could only cut down a tree within like 2 feet of your house. That's not really good for wildland fire. And not good decision making for the health of the tree. So we're trying to grow up here a little bit and do good wildland fire and good tree health.
Well, the city council has had some discussions recently about the impact of large homes on the environment and the workforce required to clean and care for these homes. I mean, does the Planning Commission take that into consideration at all?
They do, but they don't have any regulatory authority. You know, it's one thing to have a philosophical issue with respect to a large home versus a small home. You know, if you were going to take the contrarian view in terms of the amount of workforce services, if you had a 10,000-square-foot house or four 2,000-square-foot houses, who has the most driveway to clear, right? So, I mean, there's some broad conceptual issues that need to be worked through on this one, and it's not a simple problem. We have seen studies from Aspen from the late 2000s about how many people it takes to take care of a house. Our department and Pat Putt's department's got to have a conversation about how many people it takes to take care of the colony houses, right? And I don't think anybody predicted the effect of Airbnb and VRBO on service and delivery.
All right. Moving on, the city council denied the conditional use permit for 901 Woodside Avenue. The applicants have since taken that council's decision to court. Planning staff in December recommended the council approve the applicant's request to build the driveway within an unbuilt city street. So why did council deny the request?
And I'm going to have to be a little bit careful on that one because I don't have all the information on a potential appeal to the courts. But the situation is this. This was platted, unbuilt right-of-way. And right-of-way is different than property that's owned by the city. So the city has the rights-of-way, but it's held in trust for the community. And then the state law says you have to do certain things with it. That's different than our open space in Round Valley that we own. In this particular case, the whole thing started out in an attempt to protect a landmark historic site. The ultimate outcome was the city council felt like we were giving away too much of property that was held in trust in order to put this driveway in. And then second, it was difficult to do any sort of mitigation strategy to keep people from parking in that driveway or let the people know that it was allowed to walk through here because that driveway would be on public property. So there's a lot of convolutions and back and forth trying to do a good job of mitigation strategy.
Yeah, but I get. I mean, why would the city planning department approve plans for a house but doesn't allow a driveway to it?
You know, our original intention was to protect this landmark site. There's some landmark walls on it. The house was going to get restored nicely. But it was going to require a commitment of city resources to do that, and the elected officials said, no, that's not a really good idea. So that's fine. We don't have a problem with it.
Okay. Let's see. And then last week, council considered repealing land management code language around driveways within unbuilt streets. So what was the result of that decision?
They repealed it. Once again, in the 700 pages of code that we live with, Leslie, there's some stuff that lives in the 1980s that may or may not be appropriate, and there were a couple of layers of approvals that probably were inappropriate. So we agree, rightly or wrongly, with the City Council in getting rid of this section. They retain authority to manage it under an encroachment agreement or a lease agreement. Let me give you an example. So the City Council leases the spaces for our outdoor dining decks on Main Street every year, and there's a fee paid to the city for those. Whether the fee is the right level or not is a different whole question. But so we manage our right-of-way as a public resource, and I think the City Council wants to have a conversation about how we manage this public resource. In the historic district, we've already made some commitments for parking in our rights-of-way as the use of a public resource. So we use the public resource first to say, if you have a historic house, you're not required to provide parking. So we commit a portion of our right-of-way to parking. And then if you want a driveway into a new house or a historic house, we commit a portion of our public resource in order to allow that driveway to connect to our right-of-way. So there's a lot, once again, there's a lot of convoluted moving parts that make me not sleep at night.
Well, tomorrow the commission will consider another CUP for a conditional use permit for a shared driveway over the platted, unbuilt city right-of-way at 802 Empire. So what's the recommendation for that?
We're going to recommend approval on that one, and that one's a little bit different than 901. This is up on Crescent Tram and the curve between Lowell and Empire, and the road does not live correctly in the right-of-way. The road lives differently. And so in order to access this lot correctly and not off of Empire but off of Lowell, we're going to suggest that this is a good idea.
All right. And then speaking of appeals, the Park City Board of Adjustment meets to ratify its decision on the Woodside Park Phase 2 appeal, in which they sided with the appellant. So talk to us about where this goes from here. I mean, does the city completely have to redesign the development within those 25-foot setbacks?
Well, I think they're trying to decide right now what they have to do. They have a couple of options. They can appeal this decision as soon as we go through the Board of Adjustment tonight. The city can appeal, the appellant can appeal, but both of those appeals probably go to Third District Court, because we're kind of done with it at the city level, and I think everybody's had a final action. The city can redesign the project within the 25-foot setbacks, if that's what they choose to do, or they can just move the current buildings to meet the setbacks. So they have three options that they can take at this time. They just need to make a decision on what it is that's the best outcome for housing. It's a hard and complicated problem on this particular one.
Does the city feel like it has a good case, though, to move forward in court? I mean, if in fact this is just one of many, perhaps in the future to come, doesn't it need to be decided?
It needs to be decided. The planning director doesn't get involved in these kind of decisions. These are the city council decisions, and we kind of stay out of it and stay out of the way and then try and regulate fairly. So I can't answer that question.
Is that the attorney's call?
No, it's the elected official's call.
Okay.
They'll make a recommendation, and the project managers for Woodside will make a recommendation on what to do. There's a lot of money spent and a couple of years spent in the design, and the city council wants to drive housing forward. So they've got to make some policy decisions.
All right. Let's see. And then 445 King Road is a conditional use permit. This, is one of the Sweeney lots on King Road that was not acquired as part of the Treasure Hill acquisition. So why does it require a CUP?
This was an approval from the 80s. There's a couple of lots on the bottom end of Treasure Hill that were approved with houses on them back in the 80s. And then this lot was approved off of King Road back in the 80s. And the Planning Commission did not want to just give free rein in a subdivision and say you can do whatever the heck it is you want on the hillside. So they made it a conditional use. It said you got to do A, B, and C. House size is limited. Heights of the building are more rigorous than what you would see in the historic district. The roof shape is more rigorous than what you would see in the adjoining properties. And they just now you need to go through a public process and say, yeah, okay, we're in conformance with what we said we would do in 1980. I think for the most part, nobody knows that that house lives up there, and nobody knows that the house above it lives up there, unless you hike those neighborhoods. So, you know, we're working through the conditional use permit, and we're trying to go through the public process on this one.
Okay. And any updates on the city's historic preservation efforts around the Flagstaff Development Agreement?
You know, the needle is moving towards positive. There's still some final conversations about what the final financing mechanisms are. We're continuing to have conversations internally with what adaptive reuse is for the Judge Mining and Smelting Building. If you go hiking up there, you will see a substantial amount of work that Empire Pass Owners Association is paying for on the roof of that building. And so now we just need to have a philosophic conversation about what adaptive reuse is helpful on that building.
And late last year, we had hoped to shore up the Judge Office Building roof. Did that happen?
That's what they're doing on the roof. The Judge Mining and Smelting Building is the Judge Office Building.
Yeah. And then finally, just wanted to mention, I know that this is really kind of a summertime issue, except for the traffic and unloading and loading and unloading. But the Kimball Special Event Center was used during Sundance. Did you have any issues as a result of that?
We had a couple of comments from a couple of bus drivers with folks parking in the red zone. That got managed pretty carefully because, you know, I believe Special Events did a really nice job on Sundance this year. And turning Park Avenue to one-way downhill northbound probably helped. All of my department rode the bus for all 10 days, and we had to ride the bus down Park Avenue every single day. And so for the most part it worked. Sometimes a person who didn't know any better or didn't care slowed the bus down, making that corner on Heber and Park, but for the most part it worked just fine.
Okay, Bruce, anything else?
No, we're all set, Leslie. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, another Project ABC community conversation will be held Friday morning. On the phone with details, I have the manager of Project ABC, Jake McIntyre, in studio from Park City Community Foundation, Diego Zagara. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Jake, let's see, the community convening taking place Friday, 9:30 to noon at the Christian Center. What do you hope to accomplish?
So just as a quick reminder for everybody, this is part of our quarterly community convening project where we host conversations about collective priorities that came out of the Project ABC Cultural Plan, which was completed in 2018 and is now in implementation. So this particular conversation is focused on ideas of social equity as well as inclusion, diversity, equity, and access. Both kind of how the arts can be a tool for those platforms, as well as how we can make sure that the arts within Park City and Summit County are diverse, equitable, and accessible.
All right. So you've got a couple of guests coming in. Who are they?
Yeah, so we have three fantastic guest speakers for this event. We have Chandra Benito, who is the director of Art Access out of Salt Lake City. We have Amir Jackson, who is the founder and director of Nurture the Creative Mind out of Ogden. And then we have Nubia Pena, who is a director of the Utah Division of Multicultural Affairs, which is a state agency.
Okay, this falls under the collective priority of Faces in Programming. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so the Project ABC plan has a series of different priorities that were recognized by the community as we went through the planning process. And two of those are programming, and which is really about the arts activities, really the front-facing things that people engage with. And then another is faces, which we refer to as organizations and people. So with these, both of these priorities, there's recommendations about making sure that the arts are inclusive and accessible, as well as recommendations about making sure that our artists and arts organizations are receiving the proper development that they need to make sure that they're meeting the needs of the community as best as possible. So there's several recommendations from Project ABC that line up with this particular conversation.
So, Diego, why is the Park City Community Foundation part of this?
Well, we are co-hosting the event with the Park City Summit County Arts Council,
And, you know, one of the things that we've been hearing in this space around equity and inclusion is that shared language, a shared framework, is critical for us to move the work forward. For the community to be on the same page when we use those words that can sometimes be jargony was of importance. So we were invited to kick it off, so to speak, this Friday and talk a little bit about those ideas.
So give me an idea. I mean, what are you talking about that's not inclusive or, I mean, these words that...
Honestly, we're going to be covering some definitions, how these words relate to the arts world and how why we feel, the Community Foundation feels like the arts are an opportunity to provide inclusive spaces and places and happenings. So we want to be supportive of these efforts.
So can you give me an example of what is what we have in Summit County that is not inclusive or accessible to everybody? When we're talking about the arts, I mean, lots of times it's just public art. Everybody can go stand in front of it. We've got galleries that are free. Certainly we have paid performances. Is that what we're talking about?
Some paid performances, sure. But also I think that this one's a little trickier. When we talk about inclusion, there's sometimes this invisible component of how welcoming a space can be. And not everyone might feel included yet. Sometimes, I know I do. I know I feel included when I have a personal invitation. When a friend of mine asks me to join them at an event or a gathering, I know I feel like I'm part of the community. And I think that we haven't always invited everyone yet. And I think that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to build a bigger tent for everyone to feel like they belong.
Hmm. And I mean, I think about the free tickets that are given away just by Park City Institute to the Eccles Center performances. So where isn't this happening?
I mean,
we have incredible performances that I think that lots of people are invited to and for free.
Yeah, you're right. I think there's a lot of good work happening right now with partnerships with the Kimball Arts Center, the Egyptian Ballet West, another great arts organization, the Institute. I think we're all working collectively to make places more inclusive, and I think we're still not quite there yet.
Yeah. Jake, can you give me some examples of where we're not being inclusive?
What I would add to that is this difference between availability and accessibility, or availability and inclusion. Sometimes things are available to folks, but they don't always feel included or represented in what the work is or what they're being invited to. And so this is a really big push that's not just focused on Park City and Summit County right now, but this is a big push around the state and around the nation to ensure that as artistic and creative and cultural planning and programming is happening, are we really being representative and inclusive of as many people and as many cultures, many ideals, as many sensibilities as absolutely possible. And so sometimes while things might be made available by being either accessible to the public or by being made free, those things are often not necessarily accessible or inclusive. You know, and Diego mentioned this idea of invisible barriers, and sometimes it's hard for us to see those if we don't feel them, right? But there are many community members, not just within Park City, but throughout Summit County and you know throughout the state, who may feel that there is a barrier for one reason or another to accessing cultural and creative and artistic programming. And so we want to open up a conversation about this, not to point fingers at any one organization or one program, really as either good or bad, but really to open up a conversation around this idea and understand that we all have room to grow. We all have ways to be more inclusive and more representative of the cultures that we support.
So what are the Arts Council and then the Community Foundation doing to remove those barriers, to create welcoming space for Friday?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're working to do is we're recording these presentations so that they are available and accessible to folks who might not be able to attend. We know that there's no perfect date or perfect time of day to have a conversation like this, but there's a lot of people who can benefit from such a conversation. And so we'll be making sure that they are available beyond just the event itself. Of course, we want people to come and the event itself is going to be the most beneficial because that's where we can have deeper conversations. But we do want to make sure that the guest presentations are available broader. But then we're also, you know, really being thoughtful about the location that we've selected, being thoughtful about the time of day that we've selected and making sure that we feel like it's a time that as many people can attend as possible. So, you know, trying to do that and then making sure that as we do our outreach, we're reaching out directly to organizations who we feel might not necessarily come just by seeing an invitation, but we're making that personal connection, as Diego talked about, and hopefully doing our best to get those personal connections out and bring as broad of an audience as possible to this conversation.
Okay, so Diego, what has the Community Foundation done then to invite those, bring those people who may not feel included again on Friday morning?
Personal invitations is what we've seen works. Mm-hmm. Reaching out to someone directly and making them feel like they are welcome in a space is critical, and we do have an eye on inviting diverse communities.
Okay, so you've done that then for Friday? Okay. Hey, Jake, at what point is the convening complete, and when are we going to see action? When are we going to see projects? When are we going to see some forward movement? It seems like we've spent just a lot of time just talking.
I think in a lot of ways there has been significant action and significant moving coming out of Project ABC. So these conversations are ways in which we can keep the conversation going, but that doesn't mean that we're not acting at the same time. And in fact, having these conversations, I would argue, is a form of action. It's a form of continuing to bring the community together to have really thoughtful conversations about the future of the arts and culture community, as well as the future of all of Park City and Summit County. So, you know, I think by conversing and by meeting, we are acting, and there have been several projects that have manifested because of these particular conversations. But that doesn't mean that significant action isn't happening. I mean, there's wonderful things happening throughout the county in the arts and culture space that are a direct cause of the Project ABC plan. Even think about the launch of the Arts and Culture Directory that the Park City Summit County Arts Council now hosts, or some of the cultural tourism marketing that's been happening, or tracking data for economic impact of the arts. So there's a lot of things that are happening, but these conversations are a way for us to make sure that we're continuing to check in with the community and giving folks a space to share ideas and to learn together.
Okay. Everyone's welcome. It's free, open to the public. Bring a friend. Personally,
absolutely,
invite that friend or two. It's happening at the Park City Christian Center Friday morning, 9:30 to noon. Hey, guys, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:54. Good morning. Well, the inaugural celebration of the first Women's Voter Registration Day in the nation, Utah's Voter Registration Day, is happening this Friday, February 14th. In celebration of that, two Park City High School seniors have organized a voter registration period at school. In the studio, I have Voterize 2020 Challenge Ambassadors Christina Schiffman and Darian Carter, along with the co-founder of Voterize, Elsa Gary. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Elsa, let's just start with you. And it was last year that Voterize got February 14th to become Utah's Voter Registration Day through a legislative resolution?
Yes, correct. House Concurrent Resolution 16.
Let's see, that mic's not doing too good, so maybe I can have you share that one over there. Thanks.
It was via House Concurrent Resolution 16 that was introduced on February 14th, 2019, and passed both houses unanimously.
Okay. And then why was this something that you thought was important to do, you being Voterize?
Well, there are approximately 300,000 women in Utah who are eligible to vote but not registered. And we thought that would be a great way to focus on that and try and reduce that number.
Okay. So what are these 2020 Challenge Ambassadors? You have two of them here, but you've got...
We have about 520 at the moment of the 1,000 that we are hoping to recruit. And these women and male allies commit to each registering at least 20 women.
Okay. So, Christina and Darian, why did you want to be Challenge Ambassadors? This is Darian speaking.
Yeah, so my neighbor actually got me involved, and I think it's just
the underrepresentation of women in our state is unreal, and I thought that it's just a really good cause, and that got me interested in doing it, and I got my friends involved.
Okay, so have you hit your 20
I have.
Registration goal?
Yes, good. I have.
All right, and what about you, Christina? Why was it something that you wanted to be part of?
Well, I am one of the friends that Darian recruited. But like what she said, there's underrepresentation, and it's important for more women in Utah to get involved in all sorts of things that they're not involved in. And everyone's opinion matters in this situation. So, you know, everyone needs to get involved.
All right. So have you hit your 20 registration goal?
Yes, I have.
Good job. Okay.
Thank you.
And tell me, you also had to work through the high school bureaucracy to get yourself a voter registration day on Friday. Tell me about that.
We're still working on it. It's still in the works. But it's supposed to be a designated time where we're going to have students having the ability to register to vote within their classes.
So we'll just take 20 minutes out of one of our periods on Friday, and the teachers are all going to show a video and show students how to vote or register to vote, and then we're handing out forms, and that time will be designated to do that for everyone at the school.
Okay. Any idea how many that you hope to get registered?
I think we're thinking 400, because we've already done a few voter registration events at the high school, so we've covered a lot of the students, but students that have just turned 16 and need to pre-register, we'll cover them this Friday.
Okay. And this is then for just one period?
Yeah, it's just 20 minutes of our second period.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. How difficult was it to get permission to do it?
Not very difficult. I feel like we have a very supportive administration at the high school who are very willing to support the students in any way. And voting is incredibly important. And when we told them we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the first woman voting, not only in Utah, but in the United States, it really speaks to them, because they want all of their students to be involved politically and environmentally in any way that they can be involved.
Yeah. So you're not registering just women, but even though it is kind of, you're only accepting?
No, we're registering
anybody.
Everyone. Yep.
Everyone, sure. So why do you think it's important then for young people to register and to engage in our democratic process?
Well, I think that it's really important because we have a lot of issues going on right now that are not going to be affecting the later generations, like climate change, for example. This is a problem that, as you know, millennials and Gen Z, they are going to have to be dealing with this problem in their complete lifetimes. And so it's really important that younger groups are getting out to the polls and voting and participating, because the issues going on right now are going to affect us greatly in the future.
And did you want to add to that before I get a wrap up?
Yeah, I think it's also just the underrepresentation of women, but the underrepresentation of our generation, because people aren't motivated to vote.
Okay. And Elsa, you would tell me that data shows that when people start to vote at a young age, they continue to vote the rest of their lives.
That's right.
Okay.
And with Utah Women's Voter Registration Day, we are celebrating the past. We are celebrating the past and forging the future. And they are the future.
Okay. Well, good job, ladies. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 9 o'clock.